You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hello, I'm David Evans, and welcome to the media series from Wolves Fancast. This is episode 4, Documentaries and Features. Now, there's so many stories to talk about in football, and it's the documentaries and features that bring those to life. But how do you put them together? How do you find them? And how do you bring them to your audience? Johnny Phillips is one of those people who does that for Sky Sports, and I sat down with him at Sky Studios recently to talk about this subject and many more. And as always, guest views are their own. Firstly, let's talk about your career. How did you get into kind of this world? Was it something you always wanted to do, or was it something that just kind of just happened?
Well, television sort of just happened. That was sort of by accident, but I always wanted to get into the media. I was more interested initially in writing, and I went to Leeds University to do a media degree, and there were various sort of vocational work placements and what have you from that. And it was a good degree. We learned a lot about radio and print journalism as well, less so about television. And then from there, I worked for a local press agency while I was still a student. Up there called Interactive Media Services, that back in the day did the old Team Talk phone lines, you know, the 0898, all that sort of stuff. And they did all that sort of thing, as well as there were contacts within that press agency to go out and do other stuff. So I worked for a couple of local radio stations, Viking FM covering Grimsby Town, and Minster FM covering York. So it was always a radio-led thing. In fact, the very last shift I ever did on that for Viking FM was when Wolves played Grimsby on the first day of the 96-97 season, and Bully got his hat trick. Yep. So that was brilliant. That was the last job I ever did for them. That may have been why I did it. It was the last job I ever, who knows. And then there was a chance to progress around at that, and it was all great. And then one day, a mate who'd left that agency was working as the Football League reporter for Sky, and he just rang me out of the blue and said, there's a couple of editorial assistant jobs up for grabs. And it was a bit of a backward step from what I was doing in terms of reporting, but a chance to progress. And he said it'd be worth sending your CV in and trying to get an interview, which I did. And I came down and I joined the Football League team. And it was great, but I always made it clear that I wanted to get back into reporting and back through. And Sky, to their credit, were great about giving you the opportunity. So I sort of initially started out doing Vox Pops on the Football League and really basic reporting stuff, and then just moved up and to my sort of job today, which is half on Soccer Saturday and half doing the Premier League touchline reporting for Sky games that go out live in Ireland and on the Saturday afternoon stuff. So it's been great. It's been a really good mix.
And a lot of people will know you from Soccer Saturday, from the features and the reports you do.
Yeah.
In terms of a feature then, how does it work? What's the kind of the planning aspect? Do Sky come to you and say, we've got a player or a manager of X team, could you go, or is there kind of a two-way where you can come with an idea and see how it works?
It's definitely two-way. We have 3 hours to fill. So Soccer Saturday goes on air at midday, comes off air at 6, and the matches don't start till 3. So we've got 3 hours of build-up to fill. So there's a lot of features and interviews that need doing. As rights holders, we get access to players and managers through something called the broadcast preview period each week that we can apply to. But we wouldn't just carpet bomb every single club asking for an interview, because there's sometimes where editorially there's just no need and we don't want it. So it depends what players are available. And then also, and this is what more where the reporters come into it, we can then speak to our producer and say, listen, I've had an idea to do this, or there's a nice story there, can we cover that? And it's a two-way thing with the producer. In a perfect world, from my perspective, as long as the less I'm being told what to do, the better, because it means the ideas I'm putting forward are being taken on board and I can just get on with the job. But there are weeks when you know, you can't think of something new every week where we just take an interview that's available to us and then we'll go and do a fairly straightforward interview in a sanitized environment at a club's training ground. But the best ones are the ones where you've put a bit of thought into it and come up with something a bit novel. And they tend to be lower down or away from Premier League training grounds.
And what is the planning process? And so you know you're going to go to a club or speak to a player. What is the kind of planning process before you arrive in terms of research and the theme you probably want to get out of that?
Depending on the interview, if the interview is based around a team's performance or a player's own performance, that's a fairly straightforward interview. Mm. So, for example, if one week, Wolves have won 3-0 and so-and-so scored a hat-trick and we're going to interview him, that'll be a lot about his performance, his hat-trick, what it's done for him, the confidence of the team, and that's straightforward. If we're going to a club that's just sacked a manager, we'll need to know from the player what was going on, or you know, as much as he'll tell us what was going on. So it depends what the editorial slant is from the club. But if it's a feature that's nothing to do with the football, which are my favourite ones, then you just try and tell as interesting a story as possible about why we're speaking to this player. So the last one of those that I did last season was, funny enough, it was connected with Wolverhampton. We went and covered a Sunday league game, and they had the oldest set of match officials that we could find. They had a 68-year-old ref, a 72-year-old linesman, and a 79-year-old linesman.
Okay.
And it was brilliant, and it was a great standard. It was Pentandori against AFC Jax. It's a brilliant standard for Sunday league. They wiped the floor with my Sunday league team. And they had the Wolverhampton Referees Association. I'd given a talk there a month or so earlier, and one of the linesmen had put his hand up and said, you know, there's three of us officiating still. We've got to be as old as there are out there. And I thought, that's a great story. Let's go and film them. So we just went and filmed them. We mic'd up the referee, and it was great fun. We chatted to both teams, the Philip Reid from the Wolverhampton Referees Association and the match officials. And it was a really nice, colourful feature. And that's just telling a story.
Yeah. And do you get that impression now that it's not just about going to speak to a player about a certain event? People want to know more about the stories and the untold things that are going on at different football clubs.
Yeah, we always get the best response from them. Certainly, you get your big name interviews, which you go and do. Last season, I really enjoyed speaking to Jurgen Klopp a bit and Arsene Wenger. They'll always get good viewing figures. But the really interesting ones I find are the sort of human interest stories where something amusing or something colourful happens. I mean, if we've got time, there was one a couple of seasons ago where we went to the Scilly Islands off the coast of Cornwall. Yeah. It's about a 2.5-hour boat ride, and they've got the smallest league in the world there. There's just two teams who play each other every week.
Yeah, I think I've actually heard about this. Carry on anyway.
And so there's two teams, and they play each other on the same pitch every week, and brilliantly, they've got an 18-league season and a cup competition, and one of the cup competitions is two-legged. So it's just brilliant, and it's all very much tongue-in-cheek. And we went there to film this league, and they played on the only pitch on the biggest island, St Mary's in the Scilly Islands. And then as we were filming the game, streams of bird watchers started appearing at the side of the pitch with binoculars and telescopes. And we're thinking, what's going on here? This is a bit odd. None of them paying attention to the football. They were looking off into the sea or into the trees. So we got chatting to a few of them, and it was the migration season.
Right.
And the Scilly Islands is basically the hotspot for rare migrants blown off course from the Atlantic that turn up here. And all these twitchers had turned up over this weekend. So we ended up chatting to them and getting them on camera saying, well, you're not interested in the football and all this. And then as it transpired, there was a really, really rare bird had pitched up that weekend called a red-flanked bluetail. So we found out where it was. It was on a neighbouring island. And basically all of the footballers, they work in the boat industry, or the tourist industry. And one of them was a boatman. And his job the next day was to take a boat to this island with a load of twitchers. So he said, we've got to go and film this now. So the next day, long after the football had finished, we jumped on a boat with about 200 twitchers and to this neighbouring island, and we're running across the island through undergrowth, over moorland, everywhere to try and find this bird with a camera and the boatman. And it was brilliant. And we found the bird. And while we were there, we met one twitcher who said every year there's a Birdwatchers versus Islanders match that they have at the end of the season, which was a sadly, it was a week or two later, so we couldn't film that, where the Bird Watchers play the Islanders in this famous game. And it's not unusual for the match not to finish when news of a rare bird pictures up. Right, and the bird is just,
what, match abandoned after half an hour?
So it's things like that. So we went there to tell a story, and then another one emerged, which was a bit more interesting and a bit more colourful. And it's little things like that. So you go and try and, when you do it, you're quite fluid about what you want. You go with an idea, but if something interesting crops up while you're there. So, we got the story about the smallest league in the world, and but we also got this story of what they actually did in their day jobs, ferrying these mad bird watchers around. So it's all good fun.
And I guess that's what must be so rewarding about this role you do, is that you can go to an interview and you kind of sometimes don't know what you're going to expect. You probably know you're going to speak to a certain player about a certain topic, but you never know what's going to come around the corner.
Yeah, absolutely. And some of the players are really, really engaging. And it tends more to be the foreign lads, in fairness. But you get some really nice stories, really, really nice backstories to why players are here and what they're doing. Sergio Torres was a memorable one. He's an Argentinian player who played for Wickham and Peterborough back in the day. And he basically tried to make it as a professional footballer in this country. And he arrived with $300 in the back of his pocket, and ended up for the first year in England, sort of not quite sleeping rough, but in very dodgy sort of backpacker places, stacking shelves at Boots, one of his jobs, as he tried to get trials at non-league clubs, and eventually got taken on by Basingstoke, and then Basingstoke played a pre-season friendly against Wickham, and the Wickham manager, John Gorman at the time, spotted him and took him on. It's things like that. So a lot of players have nice backstories and talk about really interesting things. Billy Keir at Accrington last year, their top scorer and their talisman as they won the league, but also had a real problem with his personal life. Had depression and suffered really badly. Mm. And a year or two earlier, John Coleman had given him lots of time off, just said, just take as much as you want off, no pressure to come back. And he did, and he found a way of living with his depression, came back and helped them get promoted. So there's lots of, they're more human interest stories. Yeah. And I think they're more, I find personally more interested than talking about 4-5-1 and 4-4-2. And wasn't that a great goal you scored? But there's a place for everything. Other people prefer that. There's a place for everything.
So when you turn up to do an interview with someone, how important is it to also think about all the different things that go on with that interview? Or, for example, the different shots, or how you want the style of that piece to look?
Yeah, that's crucial as well, the technical side. And in that sense, you're in the lap of the gods with the cameramen you use. And, you get to know cameramen really well who've all got different skills at doing different things. Some can light an interview very well. Some are very good off their shoulder, getting in amongst things and making sure we don't miss the shot. And there's lots of different cameramen that are great and you like using. That's really, really important. So if it's an interview in a training ground, in a room at the pretty much like this, a bog standard room, you want to light that nicely and give it a nice look. So you need backdrops and lights and the rest of it. But for instance, the Wolves documentary we made, a lot of that was just on the cuff with the cameraman with his camera walking around the place, getting access to stuff and getting in there. And you needed that the cameraman to have those skills and not to miss something that was happening. There's nothing worse than something really good happening and you miss it. But again, you've got to sort of, you're on the fly. You don't know that something good's going to happen. Willie Bowley stood out from that, from the thing we made with Wolves.
Not the injury bit.
He was just having a massage. He had nowhere to go. He hates doing interviews. He had nowhere to go. But my cameraman was great. And he sort of stuck his camera in his face. And I tried to interview him. And he was having none of it. But we needed to be there. And we needed to try it. Whereas, had we not tried that, we wouldn't have got a nice little clip of him refusing to do the interview. So it's little things like that. So that is really important. And there's all technical sides. There's different quality cameras you use. There's different high motion shots you get. The Wolves lads at the moment producing lots of really good videos on their own club channel with a lot of nice high mo stuff they get at games. Everything has a style, and it's different ways of doing things. But that's crucial on television. There's no two ways about it. If the cameraman doesn't get you the shots and hasn't shot it in the way you want, it's no good to you. So for all that we can do all our prep and ask the right questions, were dependent on the shots. Mm. So it hugely dependent on the quality of cameramen. And luckily, you know, we've got some great cameramen, especially in the Midlands as well. So it's good.
When you go to interview someone, is there a certain way that you will try and set a question to get an answer that you would like for the feature? Or is it more the case of you set the question and you just kind of see what happens and see what answers they give?
Yeah, I think you leave it quite open-ended to start with and see what you get, but be prepared to go back to it.
Yeah.
So I'd be more inclined, rather than to go in with a direct way, giving them the opportunity to answer it in their terms initially. But then if you want to get a point, if you want them to talk about a point specifically, go back to the same question and ask them again. And there's no harm doing that. They don't mind that. As you say, well, can you speak about this more fully, or can you, you know, from this perspective, see this? Mm. So you just go, you can go, just go back and back and back until you get what you want. But quite quickly as well, if they don't want to give you something or they're not capable of giving you something,
you can kind of pick that up.
You pick that up straight away and you just move on. It varies. And they're quite open-ended sit-downs. When you just sit down with a footballer, you've got a certain amount of time, but within that time, unless you've been told by the press officer beforehand, there's nothing really too off limits. And it's very often that footballers are more happy to talk about things than the press officers are happy to let them.
With programmes like Soccer Saturday, you would say it's very much like that first 3 hours is very much like a magazine type programme.
That's
and you've
right.
got other programmes similar to that, such as like Football Focus on the BBC.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is it a challenge to try and think of new ways to do features and interviews that perhaps, you know, they may be trying to do something similar, other programs want to do similar, but also the way it's put together is different every time compared to the ones you've done previously as
Yeah,
well.
Definitely. That's a lot of pressure on that. And that's in the post-production way that a lot of that's with things like graphics and the music pieces you make up and the rest of it. Football Focus is really interesting because they've got, you know, a huge industry standard. That was sort of the model back in the day when I was a kid growing up. I love Football Focus. It was really looked forward to that every Saturday, and the fact that it's still there and still going strong is brilliant. They've got slightly less time, so they have less features. They maybe only have a couple of features, so they can put more into it. It's funny enough, when we've been both on a job where we're interviewing the same player, you can see that there'll be me and a cameraman to do the job for Soccer Saturday, but for Football Focus they'll very often have the reporter, the cameraman, a producer and a sound man. So they'll obviously go in with greater staffing levels because they're less stretched resources wise. We'll maybe do 8 to 12 features a week between us, so the cost's high. So we have to do it as cheaply as possible, where something like Football Focus, you can see because they're putting all their efforts into one feature, they can really go at it. It is a challenge to get stuff looking different and make stuff appealing. And very often we'll have the set interviews, which are what we call painted interviews, which are just an interview with paints covered it of action and match action, and they're the real bog standard ones. And then you work from there up to stuff that maybe use a lot more graphics, they'll use a lot more locations, have a lot more people in the interview itself rather than just one subject. But yeah, it's a real challenge, but it's a nice challenge, and it's good. And it's good to see, you know, Football Focus still going really strong as well.
And would you be part of that, of the post-production, sitting in, kind of looking at how it's made afterwards?
Yes. Yeah. So here we are in the edit suite. So this is where we may be different to other companies, maybe. I don't know, because I don't know how Football Focus work. But we film it, bring it back, log it all. So everything we've shot, we log, which can be quite laborious. In the case of the Wolves thing I made, there was hours and hours of footage, and you log everything with what you want, and then you do a sort of paper edit of how you want it to be put together, and then you come into this suite that we're sitting in now with an editor, and you tell him what you're looking for. You've got your time codes of everything, and the editor presses the buttons and does the technical side of it, and then I'll put the voice on, I'll have picked the music that I want on the piece, so I'll bring the music in for him, and we'll mix it all down, and if there's graphics that I need my editor to do, he'll do some graphics. So yeah, we sit together in the suite often for hours on a Friday with all the stuff we've shot in the week, editing the final package.
And something we've talked about or mentioned is the two documentaries you did recently for Sky on Wolves, which obviously a lot of Wolves fans will know of. Other teams may have kind of seen it on Sky. Working with Wolves and in the Wolf Pack. How did the first one come about? What was the idea behind it? Was it kind of you approached the club, or was it kind of a two-way conversation?
Yeah, no, I approached the club not long after the end of season dinner a couple of years ago, when I had a brief chat with Paul Berry, the media officer at the time, and Laurie Dalrymple, EMD. And we're always keen to, behind the scenes stuff at a high level is always sort of gold in a way. Mm. If you can get something a bit behind the scenes where you get access that you don't normally get, that's what we really like. And it does really well with viewers as well. So I had this idea under the new owners. I thought, I wonder if they're more open than traditional British owners who just don't let you in to do stuff. And British managers on one level aren't massively keen. So I spoke to Laurie and Dalrymple and the MD at Wolves, and he was brilliant. We had a meeting in London, and I just put forward an idea. Would it be maybe something that we could do around, say, maybe 3 days of filming, a couple of days down at the training ground, and then one of your pre-season friendlies, get in the dressing room. So it's not a competitive match, but it is a match that's important, and get a feeling of what's going on in the dressing room. And Laurie was great. Laurie and Paul Berry had been speaking about this, and they were great. And Laurie took it to Jeff Shee, and Jeff embraced it. And then, of course, you have to get Nuno on board, and Nuno brilliantly. Bear in mind, he'd only just come into this club in England, was the fourth manager Wolves had had in a short space of time, and was George Mendes's man. There wasn't necessarily a lot going for him at this time. You know, there was a lot of suspicion around Wolves at that time, and certainly about what was going on. And he was just brilliant. And he said, yeah, come in, shoot whatever you want, which again was amazing. And then if there's something at the end of it that in particular that we don't want to go to air, we'll speak to you. But he just gave us the run of the training ground and the match day dressing room. And it was great. We got, you know, really nice access, and hopefully we did Wolves justice, because we were lucky to some degree. We didn't know that Wolves would take off the way they did last season, but it was nice just to get there. And you did get that sense early on that something good was building. Just watching even the fitness coach Antonio Diaz, and watching his work and seeing what he did, and you just thought, he's different, and something could happen. And then of course when it came to the second one, because we'd earned the trust.
I was going to say, how did that one come up? Was that always planned, or was that near the end of the season you thought, hang, there's an opportunity here?
Yeah, the executive producer of the Football League at Sky came to me and said, do you think they'll be up for another one? Just when it became clear that Wolves were the story of the Championship and the Football League last year. So then, again, it was a case of going back to Laurie and saying, are we all right to come in again? And that was much more straightforward, because Nuno had seen how we worked, and because Laurie had seen it, and Jeff Shee. They were fine about that. And we went in. We had to make it slightly different. We brought in a few more external components to it and made it as different. But it was nice way of top and tailing what I thought was quite a memorable season. And I think it worked quite nicely, and it sort of showcased the very best of Wolves. And I think if other clubs were open to that, to showcase what they've got, rather than be wary of letting cameras in dressing rooms, that would make it... that would make for such... much more colourful television, and much more interesting television. So hopefully, if other clubs have seen it and want to do something down the line, maybe we could do.
As a football fan, doing this role, when you go behind the scenes and you speak to these people, and especially perhaps to an extent with the Wolves one, does it kind of oddly break the illusion that what you think of what's going on as a fan to then you see the reality? Not that there's nothing dodgy going on, but you have this kind of perception as a fan, and you go behind the scenes, and because you've perhaps done it for so long now, is that kind of fancy element of the fan, has it gone away in a sense?
Yeah, it does take the fan side out of it. I mean, I still get hugely starstruck when I go meeting these characters, like Klopp in particular last season. I remember, you know, meeting you.
Who doesn't love Klopp?
And I did quite a lot of interviews with him, either in tunnels after the match or up at Anfield, and it was great. And that you still get starstruck when you see these characters, but it does strip away the veneer very much so, and probably brings an air of cynicism into the job, which isn't bad, but it's not particularly good either. You see it for what it is, and it's a profession to people. So as a supporter. When I was a supporter before I did this, you know, you thought the players and the managers cared about the club as much as you did. And they don't. They care about the club while they're working for them. But when they move to a different club, they'll care for that club. You know, they're professional, and they can't be expected to care about it in the way a supporter does. So you accept that. And you do see things that go on. When things aren't going well, certainly. Wolves last year was great. And you just saw how much everybody involved with Wolves bought into what was going on, loved what was going on. And it was fantastic, but there are times in the not too recent past when things haven't been going well at Wolves, and you can see what's going on with players who just obviously don't want to be there, don't care, and that that brings a level of cynicism in to the job. So that it, I suppose it it does strip away the veneer. Yeah.
And when you have to go to do features for teams who perhaps aren't doing as well or struggling, is there a sense of awkwardness?
Yeah.
You turn up and you think, I've got to set the tone correct here, and I get the feeling within the place already that it's not great.
Yeah, it's not fun. I remember towards the end of last season going to do Zerd and Shaqiri at Stoke, and they were hanging by a thread, and he didn't want to do the interview. I didn't want to do the interview, and Stoke didn't want to be having to put him up to do the interview, but he did, and there was a couple of us there interviewing him. And there's an element to that where you're not going through the motions, but certainly there's only so much he can say. You know, the team are about to get relegated. What's he supposed to say? You know,
apart from like the classic cliches,
yeah, it is. And there's only so much he can say, and there's only so much anyone can dress anything up. So you do go in and get out as quick as you can from those ones. There are plenty of those.
And I just want to talk about your book, Saturday Afternoon Fever.
Yeah,
which we talked about off air that I'd read a few years ago. Fantastic book from my perspective, because each chapter, well, actually, I'll let you explain it, what the premise of Saturday Afternoon Fever is and what people can find in the book.
Yeah, it was just, I've been doing Soccer Saturday for such a number of years, and over those years accumulated what I thought was really interesting characters and stories that I'd covered. People I thought had a story to tell that had only been told in a 3 or 4 minute feature on Sky that deserved to have their story told at a greater level. And the inspiration for it, I was on a train to Swansea to interview somebody called James Thomas. Now, James Thomas was a striker for them when they were clinging for their Premier League, for their Football League survival back in the early 2000s. They played Hull City on the last day of the season in 2003 and needed to win to stay up. They had to win, and it was at the Old Vetch, which is a really atmospheric old ground, and it was packed that day. And this James Thomas character, a Swansea born and bred, by the way, scored a hat-trick, and they won 4-2 against Hull. And it was an amazing story, and he got chaired off the pitch. But then as the years went by, he sort of disappeared from the consciousness locally and had to retire quite early. And when I went back to Swansea, he was an ambulance driver, and he'd had to give up the profession really early, as his peers had gone through this great rise through the years. So he was Leon Britton and Alan Tate's teammate. And when they got promoted to the Premier League under Brendan Rodgers, he was still old enough to play and could have been playing were it not for this injury, and had to give up altogether and was now retrained and become an ambulance man. So we went to Swansea when to do a piece about this, and we went in around on his ambulance rounds for the day, just sat in the ambulance with him as he kept ferry patients here and there. And I came away from it thinking, what a story that is that no one really knew about. And I thought, I should write something about this. And I had a load of these, and I just thought, let's put a book together. And over the course of a season, I revisited some of my favourites and met some new ones. And that's how the book came about. And hopefully, I just sort of, gave a bit of limelight to people who I thought had great stories and were great characters.
I mean, it's just, before we started recording, that story I told you about, the Forest Green Rover story, about their incredible set of what they've got going on there.
Yeah.
And if you could tell us more about what it is that they've got going
on. Yeah, well, Forest Green are owned by an old eco-warrior, a fellow called Dale Vince, who he was a bit of a traveller initially, and he started making his money by setting up at Glastonbury a mobile phone unit before mobile phones were big. He took a telephone mast along to Glastonbury one year and started selling phone calls, something along those lines, and did it through a wind turbine. That was it. He took a mobile wind turbine along, which then gave an electrical charges for people to then make calls. I think that was it. Anyway, he was a bit of an eco warrior, believed in wind turbines and the rest of it, and he went on eventually to run a electricity firm called Ecotricity. And he also was a huge football fan, and he took charge of Forest Green. And he's trying to make it the world's first sort of genuinely carbon neutral football club. So they don't use any fertilizer on the pitch. It's all natural fertilizer. Rainwater is collected to use on the ground. They send this automatic lawnmower around the pitch, mulching the pitch and cutting the grass. They won't sell any meat on site.
It was this bit that really got me.
He's vegan, so everything has turned to vegan. So you go to the ground, all the food is vegan, and it's brilliant food. Last time I was there, I had this amazing vegan curry. It was fantastic. And the players' diets, he's taken red meat out of the players' diets while they're at the ground. Mm. Obviously, they can do what they want after, but they're not served meat. And it's just fantastic what he's done there. And it's just to try and bring a bit of awareness. And football fans who can be quite set in their ways, and some still are, you know, when you go there, the most of them are just eating chips with curry sauce on it. They haven't really embraced all the various offerings. But it's just a saying, you know, once a week, give vegan food a go, you know, if you're a football fan, and you know, turn up. And it's brilliant. And he's just the thought process that's gone into this, you know, to make this football club as carbon neutral as possible, and to, you know, and make people more environmentally aware, and yet doing it while taking the club up through the leagues as well. It's really hard. They don't, you know, they're not taking the easy way out of everything, and they're hoping to move to a stadium built entirely from wood in the not too distant future. They've got this site just off the motorway in Gloucestershire, and they're hoping for a stadium built entirely from wood.
Wow.
So yeah, who knows?
Just going back to the kind of interview process, from when you know you've got to go speak to somebody, how long does the process take in terms of research, writing out your questions? What, if there was like a time frame, how does it take you a couple of days or a few hours?
Yeah, for the more obvious stories, for Shaqiri, for example, it's basically an hour. The story was there in front of you. Stoke were about to get relegated. What are you going to do about it? You've got one game to save yourself. The job was done. For things like maybe the feature where we went to the Scilly Islands and the rest of it, then you've got to delve into what sort of is going on at the Scilly Islands, find out the main the industry, the employment, what makes the island work, what's going on in terms of geographically, where are nice places to go and visit and get shots of. We had to set the scene, so we have to go and get the shots while we're there. So we needed to make sure we filmed certain bits of it. And then there was a lot of back and forth with the player, the organizer, the player we organized it all with, saying, can you make sure so-and-so is going to be here for us? We're going to need this, we're going to need that. Timings. So there's a lot. Lots of preparation goes into that. I mean, travel for something like that was a nightmare to organise. It was a 12-seater plane we ended up getting, and we only had a certain amount of baggage space for the camera equipment. So again, we had to be careful what we took out there. So things like that will take days on end to organise, but a straightforward interview is a matter of hours.
And I guess that planning is so important, because if you just turned up with a standard number of questions, you're just going to get the standard answers,
yeah,
aren't you?
Definitely.
And if you try and mix it up and do the research and find some interesting things, you are then going to expand that out.
Yeah, and you can get found out. And there was one occasion I really got found out, and it wasn't entirely my own fault, but I went up to Middlesbrough years ago to interview Mark Crossley, and I think it later turned out he'd had a training ground bust up with whoever the manager was. It might have been Steve McLaren, I'm not sure. Anyway, and he didn't do the interview, so they put up the captain, Gareth Southgate, instead. And we were given a last-minute sort of heads-up on this, but I didn't know enough about what Gareth Southgate had been up to lately. So he comes in to do the interview, and we're unawares, and my cameraman's still twiddling with the lights, and you have to make small talk with the player as you're there. So the player's sat opposite me, and I'm putting the microphone on and making small talk. England had played Holland the previous night in a terrible match, so I just asked him, just to make small talk, I said, did you watch the England-Holland match? And he gave me this really strange look. And I just thought, and sort of didn't really respond. So I just sort of laughed. I said, well, no good, was it? And he sort of just nodded. And then we did the interview. And then at the end of the interview, the cameraman said to him, did you not realise he played in the match? And I did. Obviously, I didn't. So, you know, there are times when you get caught short. Yeah. You make a bit of a fool of yourself. If you're under-prepped, definitely. It's as well. You can never over prep for something, and again, that's more. It can sometimes be more relevant for the interviews that you're doing at the game, the touchline interviewing, the tunnel interviewing before and after a match, where managers are slightly harder to work with. The tensions are higher, and the rest of it, you've got to make sure you've covered all bases and know about selections and formations and what's going on, just so that you don't ask a question that they can throw back at you.
And I guess post-match, in those type of scenarios, depending on the result, you've got to change your tone of voice.
Oh, massively, yeah.
Because again, if a result hasn't gone the way that person wants, you've really got to be careful of how you word those questions.
Yeah, there's so many like that, especially the sort of the larger-than-life characters in the Premier League. Yeah, well, there's one with Jose Mourinho that springs to mind, when Chelsea drew at home to Burnley 1-1. And he was fuming. He was fuming with the referee. There'd been a sending off and there'd been a few other decisions. And he came out with a face like thunder. And I sort of went in with a very open-ended question. The more open-ended opening question you can have for a tunnel interview, the better. Just to let them lead where they want to go rather than go in with a diabolical type sort of line. And he said, I'm not going to talk about the match. I'm just going to talk about these minutes. And he reeled out four separate times of minutes to me and said, that's all I want to talk about, which were obviously four incidents that he thought the referee had let them down. And your heart sinks and think, well, you know, we've got 2 minutes to fill here. That's not going to get me anywhere. So you then try and coax him around. And there are various ways of, you know, trying. Sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. In the end, that particular one, he ended up giving us 2 minutes. He eventually got there when we sort of said, you know, supporters want to hear a bit more. And he was okay. But, you know, you've got to be sort of prepared for the worst.
And there's so many stories you've talked about there, where it's on Soccer Saturday or through your book. Is there a particular story or a particular report you've done that's your favourite that kind of really sticks out in your mind?
Yeah, there is, definitely. It was with Gretna, who were a sort of tiny Scottish team. And we initially got hold of the Gretna story when Jeff Stelling received a Christmas card from their striker, Kenny Duker. And this is going back to about 2003-04. And they had a striker who was a part-time doctor. They were in the bottom division of Scottish football, and they had a striker who also worked as a doctor, and he scored loads of goals. And whenever he scored, Jeff Stelling used to say on television, "Are the good doctors scored for Gretna?" And we got this Christmas card from him saying, "Can you give a shout out to my grandma? She watches every week and she gets so proud. Granny May, she was called." And so Jeff gave me the Christmas card. He said, "You should go up and do a piece with her." And we did. And she was a right character, and she was really good fun. And we did this nice piece with Kenny and his grandma. And as a result of that, we got sort of, we got in with Gretna, and they were being bankrolled at the time by this real sort of philanthropist, but he had an odd backstory. He was a fellow called Brooks Mileson, a local businessman from just south of the border, who ran an animal sanctuary in the gardens of his own house, where they took in all sorts of odd animals. Like, we went to see him when he had kangaroos, ostriches, turtles, everything. He basically ran this exotic animal sanctuary for people who injured animals or animals that had been discarded. And he was a colourful story. And then the more we sort of got hold of Gretna, they were coming up the leagues at that stage. And it was an amazing story what they did. They were basically a part-time English football club in the Northern Premier League, or the Northern League, in playing in England, even though they were just over the border in Scotland. 50 fans, 50 to 100 fans at best. The manager, Rowan Alexander, was the groundsman, and he did all that. But this philanthropist saw the club and decided, tried and failed to buy Carlisle. So he went to Gretna and he got them elected to the Scottish Football League. So you got this tiny non-league team elected to the Scottish Football League. And he did give them a fair few quid, but not enough for the success story to unfold as it did. They won every division all the way up to the Premier League. When they were still in the third tier, they reached the Scottish Cup final. Okay. And they only lost on penalties to Hearts, and they went into Europe as a Scottish second division, which is the third tier of Scottish football team. And then they reached the Premier League, and then they had to move to Motherwell because the ground was too small and it all fell apart, and Brooks Mileson got ill, their benefactor, and they folded. And this whole thing happened between 2002 and 2008. So all that happened in a 6-year period, and they just disappeared. And there were lots of little side stories, like Kenny Duker being a doctor and never playing for the club full time, only being part time for them. And it was just a great story. So I eventually made a documentary about those six years at Gretna called The Club That Vanished. It's still on, rolling around on Catch Up on Sky. And I loved doing that. And it was just, I thought, what a story. And there were so many elements to it. And just this tiny team. And Gretna sort of reformed as a tiny Lowland Leagues club. And they're back where they were now. 50 fans turn up to watch them in the Lowland League in Scotland. And it's this tiny village. You could drive through it in a minute. You know, it's a tiny village. And I just made this story about what an amazing 6 years they were, where their world was turned upside down. They were playing in the UEFA Cup. They were Hampden Park. 14,000 fans went to see them at Hampden Park when the village only has a population of 2,500. So it was little. That was, I think, the Gretna story is definitely my favourite.
The people listening to this, younger people who may listen thinking, I'd really like to do a role that you do, or get into industry and work in, you know, Sky or BBC, or, you know, this kind of world. What tips would you give to people about getting a foot in the door, or what experience or skills do you think they need to start their journey?
I think you do have to do some form of journalism qualification these days, or at the very least a sort of maybe English, just so you're equipped with that level. And then I think it's all about opportunity and chance. I think you've got to be prepared for knockbacks and keep knocking on the door asking for an opportunity. It's quite a competitive industry, so to get where you want to get, you're going to be rejected lots of times, and that can be dispiriting. So you need a thick skin. I was lucky in that I got wind of a job at Sky quite early on, so I didn't have to go through that knockback process. But I know lots of people who did, and it is hard, and you can question yourself and the rest of it. Working for free early on, you know, you've got to do placements, work placements, help out. There's all sorts of media entities that are happy for people to work for them for free. They need the labour. So when you're a student or a sixth former or what have you, that sort of can be a way in. And just keep your ear to the ground. There might always be an opportunity somewhere. There's an editor at Sky now who I do most of my editing with. A great lad, and he was a runner, I think, during the Olympics, at the 2012 Olympics, and bumped into a Sky News reporter. And he was just running fairly menial running jobs. And he pestered the Sky News reporter for his contact details, rang him up, got hold of him, said, you know, if there's any opportunities coming at Sky. And eventually there were some freelance shifts available. And he came in on Sky and he started off as a runner on Soccer Saturday, just making cups of tea and the rest of it, and progressed up. And now he's a really top-notch editor who cut some really nice stuff. So there's... it's being prepared to pester people, ask people for opportunities. It's hard. I mean, the initial advice I may have given years ago when I started may not be applicable now. There's lots, the media's changed. I mean, you know, podcasts, as we were saying, have come onto the scene. And that's a way in which people who go from an amateur base with no formal journalistic qualifications can then find that their podcast becomes a really important form of media, and that gets them in.
Yeah.
So having just said you need a journalism qualification, I'm going to contradict myself now and say maybe you don't. There's so many different ways in. You see the YouTubers of today, and you know, so whereas I needed a journalism qualification, maybe there are different routes in now. So I think you've got to just try and sniff out opportunity where possible. That's some advice I'd probably give.
The final question then, which we ask everybody on these podcasts, is where do you see sports media, football and media in the next decade? How do you think it will look? How do you think it will be reported on? Where do you see it going?
Football, from our perspective, live football is the essence of what Sky Sports does. I don't know how much will change in terms of the live football, us wanting to cover it. I think people sit down and watch television for live football still. Where I think it's changing massively is that the kids coming through aren't watching television. That's quite apparent. They're watching YouTube, the Instagram, Snapchat, and they're sort of taking their content through different ways. So I think we need to be very aware that there are different ways of consuming content. For example, going back to the post-match interviews that I do, when I first started doing those, the only way they'd be seen initially was on Sky Sports at the end of Soccer Saturday, and then on Sky Sports News through the night. Well, now they're up online immediately. They're into 30-second clips on Twitter. They're everywhere. You know, they're on Instagram. So that reaches a whole new audience and a bigger audience. So our stuff can find a greater audience, but not necessarily a greater paying audience. So I think the media is developing along the lines of particularly social media. But I think the age is changing all the time, and something relevant today may not be relevant in 10 years' time. It's hard to predict, but I think you have to embrace everything coming our way. If you stand back and say, oh, people sitting down to watch Soccer Saturday at 12 o'clock is the only way we want to go, you're on shaky ground. I think it is changing. People are taking their content in so many different ways. It's changing all the time.